This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Welcome to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. It's your host, Tim Link, and I'm super excited you're joining me today. We got a great, great show. Of course, we've got author and a conservation biologist with a PhD in zoology, Louise K. Blight. And Louise is going to talk to us a little bit about her latest book, Where the Earth Meets the Sky, a story of penguins, people, and a place in the Antarctica. Oh man, it's such a good book. So we're going to talk to her a little bit about the book itself and how it came about, learn a little bit more about what she does in particular with this particular book. And then we'll wrap it up with finding out, how was the writing process? Super duper easy, or was it, oh my gosh, how am I ever going to get through this thing? She's a pro. She knows how to do it. So everybody hang tight. We'll come back right after this commercial break. You're listening to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio.
Take a bite out of your competition. Advertise your business with an ad in Pet Life Radio podcasts and radio shows. There is no other pet-related media that is as large and reaches more pet parents and pet lovers than Pet Life Radio. With over 7 million monthly listeners, Pet Life Radio podcasts are available on all major podcast platforms. And our live radio stream goes out to over 250 million subscribers on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, TuneIn, and other streaming apps. For more information on how you can advertise on the number one pet podcast and radio network, visit PetLifeRadio.com/advertise today.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Joining me now is author and conservation biologist and a PhD in zoology, so that's always exciting to me. Of course, Louise K. Blight. Louise, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tim. Good to be here.
Yeah, we're super excited to have you on, and I love this book from the get-go. You know, your latest, Where the Earth Meets the Sky, story of penguins, people, and a place in Antarctica. I mean, great topic. People love penguins, but all the details behind it and what you had to go through to get to this book is going to be the interesting thing. So tell us a little bit about it and how it all came about.
Well, the book came about in the beginning because I've worked in Antarctica quite a bit in my career. I started out as a seabird ecologist, but a big part of that work initially when I was doing my undergraduate degree was working on cruise ships in Antarctica and being a naturalist and driving tourists around in zodiacs. So I'd spent time in Antarctica, tour guide and a biologist, so I was collecting data at the sites that I was going to, so counting penguins sort of thing, penguins and seals, and making those data available to an organization that was monitoring various sites and also the Scientific Committee on Antarctic Research. That was all great, but I was actually interested in going to Antarctica to do some research, maybe for a master's or a PhD. And I ended up being offered this position that I write about in the book. The experience I write about in the book is actually going and living on a place called Ross Island at the furthest south, the Daly Penguin Colony in the world, and working as a research assistant for somebody who'd been studying penguins there for decades. And so when I was offered the job, it was, you know, obviously something that not many people get to do. And I said to one of my colleagues at the time, I could write a book about this. And I decided I'd keep a daily journal because it's journaling is something that I'd done. And I thought, well, it's not an experience that people get to have. And, you know, like anything in life, the interesting things become commonplace once you get used to them. And I wanted to kind of capture those experiences before they did become commonplace to me. So the long and short of it was I went off on this three-month trip to Antarctica to live at a penguin colony and work there, kept a journal, and then came home and life went on, started a PhD after a couple of years. But I always had in the back of my mind that I wanted to write this book. Time went by and I thought, well, is it relevant anymore? But, you know, the world was changing and I thought, you know, I think people really do want to hear about Antarctica. Antarctica's in the news. People always love penguins. And I eventually decided, yes, I am going to turn this into a book. And so I was working as a biologist at the time when I decided to sit down and start doing this work. And I remember saying to one of my neighbors, as I'm taking 6 months off work to write a book about my trip. And she'd actually written a couple of books about kayaking around Vancouver Island and kayaking around the Gulf Islands where we live. And so she knew what writing was like. And she said, "You're taking 6 months off to go and live in Antarctica in your mind. That's wonderful."
Oh, wow.
And so that was the writing process for me, was going back to that time and recreating it in a way that I thought that readers would be interested in.
Wow. You know, it is so fascinating, and I'm sure it's foreign to me. You know, it seems like a magical process that you went through, that obviously you've trained, you study, you know what to do. But just the idea of, okay, I want to study the penguins and the birds in Antarctica. So how do I do that when I'm first starting off? Well, I do cruise ships. I do, you know, show people around and whatever. And while I'm doing that, I'm learning and applying that to my skill set. And then later on, this opportunity just presents itself. It seems like a real magical journey to get to this point, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, well, I think I've been lucky as a scientist and somebody who's been able to work in really remote places. So I did my master's degree on rhinoceros auklets, which are a puffin relative, and lived for 2 summers for 3 months each year in the middle of nowhere on an island out in the Pacific studying them. And so I've lived in remote places a lot doing my research, studying wild birds. And I always feel really fortunate to be in those places because they're remote and they're also really beautiful. And, you know, a seabird colony it's a wildlife experience like no other one if you're working there, because there are just so many, you know, thousands of birds or hundreds of thousands of birds sometimes that you're surrounded with as you're doing your research. And, you know, these are very remote places that you only get to go to if you have the ability to go there and study them.
Yeah. Sitting back thinking about it, you think, wow, that sounds, as a novice here, I'm speaking, you know, it sounds lovely and it would be fantastic to do. But I would imagine most people that don't have your skill set, you know, after about 3 or 4 days, that's it. You can't do it anymore. But was this something you were always comfortable with and always interested in doing? I know at times I imagine it had its fair share of challenges, but is this something that's like, yeah, I could adapt to this and I actually enjoy this?
I think a lot of people who work in the field as wildlife biologists are introverts, and they're people that often are more comfortable with non-human animals than with humans, like a lot of us, I think. I think that's relatable for many people who are not biologists. But then we get to apply that to our professional lives. And, you know, I'm quite an introvert, so it's not hard for me to go and spend a long period of time away from most other people, especially if you're in the company of other animals. So a colleague was asking me recently, I was talking about the experience of living on Ross Island in the study that I talk about in the book. And she said, "Do you think you would have been lonelier if there weren't penguins there?" And I said, "Oh, that's a really good question. I hadn't thought about that." And yes, absolutely. Or, you know, penguins or other wildlife there. Absolutely. You know, being in a landscape like that with no other wildlife and just another couple of people would have been a very different experience than being able to walk down to the penguin colony every day and, you know, visit our study birds and look around and see them and hear them and especially smell them. They're very stinky.
Yeah, I was wondering, is that, do you ever get adjusted to that part of it? And if so, do you need to bring that back to your normal life when you're back in your house?
Adjusted how, you mean?
Once you get used to penguin smells, you always have to have penguin smells around.
Oh, no, I wouldn't say it's something that you crave smelling. Like I said, they're pretty stinky. Their diet is fish and krill and that sort of thing. So their guano is very fishy smelling and full of ammonia and very strong. So it's not something that you miss, but it's more like something that you, at least for me as a seabird scientist, I associate with fond memories of working in those places, but it is something that you have to get used to and to kind of put into the back of your mind when you're around it all the time.
So when you're there, walk me through just a brief average day. You wake up, I'm sure like most of us, we have to have some caffeine or wake up something other to get us going. What is a day like and what are you looking for in particular case? So you're tracking specific birds or patterns, or what does an average day look like?
I'll talk about an average day at the penguin colony that I write about in the book. And just to step back for a minute, just to remind people that it's Antarctica, it's the height of summer. And so every day is just like the other one because it's 24 hours of daylight. So you don't really, you know, we call things the night, but the night is when you go to sleep in your sleeping bag and it's still broad daylight out. One of the interesting things like that about that is that you enter physiological free run. And so your circadian rhythm gets off by a little bit every day. And so if you just keep going with what your body's doing, you'll eventually start going to bed at, you know, 4 a.m. and getting up at 1 p.m. and just getting to bed later and later and getting up later and later. So your comment about your question about is coffee a big part of the day? It absolutely is. Helps you to wake up in the morning after you've gone to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning. But yeah, get up out of your tent, go into the main hut, make coffee, wash your face, sit down at your computer, maybe enter some data from the day before. If the weather's bad, then you have to wait in the hut until the weather gets better, or maybe not. Maybe the weather gets worse and you have to stay there and figure out what you're going to do for the day. But if the weather's good, then you know, you eventually stop procrastinating about going outside and starting the day and go down to the colony and begin your work. So that could be something like, we spent a lot of time band searching. And what that means is that we were walking around with our binoculars looking for penguins that had flipper bands from a previous year. So that was a big part of what we were doing in the study is looking at from band data, you can get things like, you know, how old is the bird? When was it? What's what? You know, you read the band number and you then write that down and enter the data in the computer later on. And so you have a record of all these known age birds that are reappearing at the colony. The name of the study was at that time was the geographic structuring of Antarctic penguins. And so what we were looking for was banded birds that had moved among colonies. So there were three or four colonies in the area that we were studying. Generally, what we say about seabirds is that they're very philopatric, so they go back to the colony where they were hatched and raised. But when environmental conditions change, then we don't know if that's the case. And so it was a year of strong environmental change that I'm writing about in this book. And so we had a lot of movement of penguins among colonies. And so that's unusual, and we were documenting that. We were also documenting things like number of eggs laid per parent. So basically, we want a record of penguin productivity by pair through the season. So how many chicks did they produce? Do the chicks survive to fledging and that sort of thing? What are they feeding their chicks? So those are all the sorts of things that we would be documenting as we're walking around the colony on a given day, recording data before we go back to the hut and make dinner and go into our sleeping bag for the night and then start it all over again the next day.
Yeah, fantastic. So I had to ask from a novice standpoint again, is each bird has a band, and I'm sure that's there's some sort of a code that goes with that band, but do you end up naming some of the particular birds by Fred, Charlie, or Ethel?
We don't band every single bird because, well, one, there are just so many penguins there, it would be absolutely impossible to do. We just band a subset of birds to look at the productivity of that known cohort of birds so we can identify them. And then we then band a number of chicks in the colony in any given year. So again, in the following year, we can go back and do the same thing again of looking at where the chicks from previous years are showing up. Are they coming back to the same colony, or are they going to different colonies? So we get to know our study animals, actually, absolutely. You know, just like any study where we think we're being objective about what we're looking at. We're certainly objective about the data that we collect, but you do end up forming a bit of a relationship with the animals. But no, I would never name a study animal. That's not what a lot of scientists would do, because the way I think of it in my own mind is I think lots of scientists would just think it's unscientific, but in my mind, I think, well, I don't know what its name is. It's pretty presumptuous of me to tell it what it's called.
Well, I get it. I get it. But I would imagine, you know, from an outsider looking in, there are certain ones that you have to, though you're there for a scientific approach and a study, there's some of them you probably have to form some sort of an attachment to. I wouldn't say a relationship per se, but I would imagine that there's one or two that you look for more often than others. Am I being presumptuous about that?
I mean, I think any study that you do with wild animals, you end up coming to know them. I don't know that you necessarily form more of a relationship with one than the other, but certainly some impose themselves on your consciousness more. So I write about one particular penguin in the book, number 1091, and she ends up being very badly injured in a leopard seal attack. So she shows up in the colony one day, completely covered in blood and barely able to move, and happens to be one of our banded birds. And so that's one of the sub-stories of the book, is Penguin 1091 and how she manages to get back to her nest despite her injuries and what happens to her and her mate through the season.
Nice. Very fascinating. Very fascinating work indeed. Well, we're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll come back and continue our conversation with Louise K. Blight in her book, Where the Earth Meets the Sky. Everybody hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Hi, this is Tim Link, animal communicator and pet expert, and host of Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Have you ever wanted to know what your pet is really thinking? Do you want to find out if they truly understand what you're trying to tell them? Or wish you could build a better understanding and closer relationship with your pet? Well, now you can. Learning to Communicate with Animals is a 4-part on-demand workshop. In the workshop, you'll learn the essential techniques that are necessary to communicate with animals, including what is animal communication, breathing correctly to achieve the perfect state to communicate with your animals at a deeper level, using guided meditation exercises as a method to communicate with animals, and how to send and receive information from your animals. So if you're wanting to learn how to communicate and connect with your animals at a deeper level, visit petliferadio.com/workshop and purchase and download Learning to Communicate with Animals. You'll be glad you did.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Continue our conversation with author and biologist Louise K. Blight and her book, Where the Earth Meets the Sky, A Story of Penguins, People, and a Place in Antarctica. So, Louise, we talked about before, in the first part of the show, we talked a little bit about you started journaling. You know, it's part of a natural thing to do, to log everything you're seeing and going through. I imagine if, like most of us that journal, you end up with a large stack of journals. So when you finally sit down and take that 6-month hiatus to write this particular book, Where the Earth Meets the Sky, how do you sort through those journals? How do you determine, okay, what makes the book, what doesn't? What is the chronological flow? How does it work? Do you start with the first journal and work your way through it, or do you have to mix and match?
Yeah, that's a good question about the whole writing process. And I've always kept journals when I've traveled. I've traveled a lot, and they used to be physical journals. On this particular trip, I had a big notebook with me and I filled it, and then just, of course, decided, well, this is ridiculous. I should just enter it all into my computer instead of, you know, sitting down with this pencil and hard copy notebook, because I'm going to eventually have to put it into a computer anyway. So I had kind of a hybrid set of entries, and you know, obviously the advantage of writing something down in a physical notebook is you can carry it around with you, but our field camp machines were laptops, so I ended up just carrying that around with me, and we had a little refuge hut that was down the hill from our main research hut, so I would go down there and write sometimes as well. But to answer your question about pulling it all together into a book, I mean, I initially thought, when I thought I could write a book about this experience, I thought I would just maybe elucidate for the public what it's like to study penguins in the remotest place on Earth. And then I sat down with everything that I'd written about, which in some cases were, I think I could say quite just poetic musings on what a beautiful place I was in and you know, the wonder of being somewhere with just one other person and in the middle of nowhere. And then other times I'd just be talking about the weather and what we had for dinner and things like that. So you can't really write a novel or sorry, not a novel. You can't write a narrative about that sort of thing. It's just too boring. And so I guess what I want to say is that I took the information that I had and started to think about what the story was that was in there and pulled information from other places. So from papers that I had worked on subsequently or that colleagues had worked on, old writings from explorers who had been at the same site as us 100 years ago, information about penguins and skuas and whales that we were seeing there every day, and sort of thought about the narrative arc of what had happened. So there was a story there for me. There was a place that I went to and a study I participated in and things I learned. And then I left and went home and was changed by the whole experience. And so how do you describe that in a way that's interesting for someone else to read about? And so that's a lot of what I thought about when I was pulling narrative out of the journals is how do we talk about such things in terms of it being a story? And so, like I said, I look for things that would interest the average person. And also thought a lot about, well, how do I bring myself into this? Because I mentioned I'm an introvert, and so I didn't want to write a lot about myself. So for me, you know, when you share these sorts of things about people, they often say, well, I want to know more about what you thought about this or what happened to you. So it was, for me, it was for finding the balance of talking about personal things, but in a way that's interesting and relatable for anyone who might read this.
Yeah, you did a great job with that. When your publicist first contacted me about it, I thought, okay, well, this will be a fascinating topic. I'm sure we're going to learn a lot more from a scientific standpoint, learn things that we don't know, put us into that place a little bit from learning more than, you know, penguins being these cute animals that walk around and do their thing. So that was fascinating enough. But I love the fact, and I love what you just said, putting your sort of author hat on, is like, how can I get this message out, but also put people into the book? What I experienced, learn a little bit about me, learn a little bit about the science, learn about the penguins, and wrap it all up in something that is not overly scientific and technical, but has some bits in there, but yet gives some insight on who you are as a scientist and as an author and as a biologist, and as well as these lovely photos that really capture everything and put you even further into the book, because you can identify that the middle of the book has beautiful color photos and it really connects you with not only the animals, but the places and the huts and the, you know, the hut, as we call it, or whatever it may be. It really puts you there and says, okay, now I know what that's all about. So I think you did a fantastic job of taking all these different pieces and saying, okay, how can we make this broad enough for everybody to really understand, learn, and enjoy the book at the same time?
Yeah, I was talking to one of the publishers about it and said, you know, I'm kind of interested as to why people are interested in this book. You know, apart from the fact that it's about penguins that everyone loves. And she said, well, I just think there's so much that's relatable there in terms of everyone knowing what it's like to be alone and everyone knowing what it's like to be lonely and feeling like they're cut off from society sometimes and feeling that they value the company of non-human animals more than they value the company of humans. All those sorts of topics are the sorts of things that many people can relate to.
Yes, yes. Especially when you're sitting in the middle of traffic somewhere, you can really relate. I'd rather be with my animals at this point, for sure.
I would rather be in Antarctica.
That's it. Anywhere but here, please. I get it. Well, let me ask you then real quick about, you've obviously studied the penguins and as you mentioned, all kinds of different other birds out there. Do you have a favorite? Put you on the spot there, but also the attraction to penguins per se compared to, you know, some of the other fascinating birds that you've studied.
Do I have a favorite penguin or do I have a favorite seabird?
Yeah. Do you have a favorite seabird? That would be question number one, without putting you on the spot. And the second is, when we talk about penguins, we see a lot of stories, a lot of background books, different things like that. And a penguin always is one of the forefront of the seabirds. And why do you think that is?
Yeah. I mean, as a seabird scientist, you know, I think maybe asking one of us what our favorite species is maybe a bit like asking a parent what their favorite child is.
Don't, hey, we won't tell anybody. This only gets broadcast to millions of people, but shh, we won't say.
I mean, yeah, I can't say that I have a favorite penguin species. I feel really lucky to have studied Adélie penguins and also to have been in places where there are emperor penguins around. Not that mm-hmm. our studies were working on those, but they were in and out of the colonies that we were working at. I'm particularly partial to albatrosses, pelagic seabirds in general, because I've worked at sea a lot. And from the perspective of being at sea, being able to see these marine birds that are accompanying your ship in the middle of the ocean is pretty special. And of course, mariners have had those relationships with albatrosses for centuries.
Wow. So I see the next book, you know, My Life and Times with the Albatross, maybe not the right title, but yeah, because I think that's a fantastic topic, because that is a bird everybody sort of knows, but most don't. So they would have to research, do a quick Google search on what that's all about. But also everybody's always had this affinity for the sea. Most of us have, just hopping on a ship and going. So anyway, so when your editor listens to this, we won't not put pressure on you, put book number two coming along. I see it now.
Yeah, or perhaps it'll be about gulls, which is what I study now.
We love it.
The complete opposite of penguins.
Ooh, there we go. So, and fantastic. You may be on the show multiple times. So we look forward to that for sure.
Oh, yeah.
So tell us, when everybody picks up a copy of the book, Where the Earth Meets the Sky, Story of Penguins, People, and a Place in Antarctica, and you read through it, what do you hope the reader gets from it? Is there a main goal that you had, or if you get a note back saying, I really enjoyed your book because of blank, what would you hope to gain from that?
I think the main reason I wrote the book was to share what that world is like, what it's like to do penguin research, and just to tell a story that people could immerse themselves in. I think I see the book as partly escapism, because you can escape in your mind to Antarctica, to this I'll say unspoiled place, although it's not completely unspoiled. But it's also got elements of the reality of today's world in it, and a reminder of what humans are doing and how we're impacting the natural world. And so I think for me, the important message of the book is that wilderness is really important, wildlife is really important, and human beings should be doing whatever we can to protect those and honor them and honor their places in our world.
Nice, nice, beautiful message. Definitely agree with you wholeheartedly. Louise, where can people find out about you and your work and all the things going on, and obviously where to pick up the book, Where the Earth Meets the Sky?
If people just do a search on the title, Where the Earth Meets the Sky, it's available everywhere online, and it should be available through people's local independent booksellers, being published by Pegasus in the United States and Penguin Random House Canada in Canada, among other places.
Love it. Love it. So everybody go out and pick up a copy of the book, and obviously keep track of what's going on, all the wonderful work that you do. The book, once again, is Where the Earth Meets the Sky, A Story of Penguins, People, and Place in the Antarctica by Louise K. Blight. Louise, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's a very fascinating book. I love the touches you put in it, the photos I mentioned before, but also, you know, it put me in a place where I felt like I was there without my parka, of course. But so it's a great
and comfortable at the same
That's it. Sitting back drinking a Mai Tai while I learn about penguins. So I think it's a perfect mix.
Well, thanks, Jim. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Absolutely. So everybody pick up a copy of the book, Where the Earth Meets the Sky by Louise K. Blight. Thanks for coming on the show. We appreciate it. And we will look forward to seeing those next one, two, three books, Gulls, Albatross, and more. I love it. So we're coming to the end of the show today. I want to thank everyone for listening to Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. I want to thank the producers and sponsors for making this show possible. If you have any questions, comments, ideas for the show, please drop us a line at PetLifeRadio.com. And while you're there, check out all the other wonderful shows and hosts. It's a cornucopia of penguin fun. So it's PetLifeRadio.com. So until next time, write a great story about the animals in your life. And who knows, you may be the next guest on Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Have a great day.
Let's Talk Pets every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.